Carnet by Albert Camus. Program 2, Love.
Trust and friendship. Sun and white houses. Scarcely grasped shades of meaning. Oh, my untouched moments of happiness are already drifting away and offering no more help in the gloom of the evening than a young woman's smile or the understanding glance of shared friendship. He said, we must have one love, one great love in our life, since it gives us an alibi for all the moments when we are filled with motiveless despair. We do not have feelings which change us, but feelings that suggest to us the idea of change. Thus, love does not purge us of selfishness, but makes us aware of it, and gives us the idea of a distant country where this selfishness will disappear. It is to Jeanne that some of my purest joys are linked. She often used to say to me, "You're silly," was her expression, the one she used when she laughed. But she always said it when she loved me most. We both came from poor families. She lived a few streets away from me, in the Rue du Centre. Neither of us ever went out of our own neighborhood, for everything brought us back to it. And in both our homes we found the same sadness and the same sordid life. Our meetings were a way of escaping from all this. Yet today, when I look back over so many years and see her face like a tired child's, I realize that we were not really escaping from it, and that what is now priceless in our love stemmed from this very shadow which this poverty cast over us. I think that I really did suffer when I lost her, but I had no feelings of rebellion. This is because I'd never really felt at ease in ownership. Regret has always seemed more natural to me. And although I can see my feelings quite clearly, I've never been able to stop thinking that Jeanne is much more a part of me at a moment like today than she was when she stood a little on tiptoe to put her arms round my neck. I can't remember how I met her, but I know that I used to go and visit her at home. Her father worked on the railway, and when he was at home he always sat in a corner looking thoughtfully out of the window, his enormous hands flat on his thighs. Her mother was always doing housework. So was Jeanne, but in such a light and carefree manner that she never looked as if she was really working. She wasn't very small, but always looked so to me, and I felt that she was so light and tiny that I always had a twinge of sadness when I saw her dart across the road in front of lorries. I can see now that she was probably not very intelligent. At the time, I never thought about it. She had her own particular way of playing at being cross that almost made me cry with delight. And this heart, now closed to so much, can still be touched by the memory of the secret gesture she'd make when she turned round and threw herself into my arms when I begged her to forgive me. I can't remember now whether I wanted her physically or not. I know that everything was mixed up and that all my feelings melted into tenderness. If I did want her, I forgot about it the first day that in the corridor of her flat she kissed me to thank me for a little brooch I'd given her. With her hair drawn back, her uneven mouth with its rather large teeth, her clear eyes, straight nose, she looked that evening like a child that I'd brought into the world for the sake of its love and tenderness. Helped by Jeanne herself, who always called me her big friend, I kept that impression for a long time. There was a strange quality in the joys we shared together. When we got engaged, she was 18, I was 21, but what filled our hearts with grave and joyful love was the official character that it now had. And for Jeanne to come home with me, for Mother to kiss her and call her my girl, were all opportunities for rather ridiculous moments of joy that we made no attempts to hide. but Jeanne's memory is linked in my mind with an impression that I shall never be able to express. I can still feel it, however, and I only need to be sad, see a woman whose face touches me, and then come across a brilliantly lit shop front, to find Jeanne with me again, her face turned towards me as she says, "How lovely," and be hurt by the truth of the memory. It was at Christmas time, and the local shops made a great show with lights and decorations. We'd stop in front of the confectioner's window, and chocolate models, the imitation rockwork of gold and silver paper, the snowflakes of cotton wool, the gilded plates and rainbow-coloured cakes, all sent us into raptures. I felt a little ashamed, but I could not hold back the upsurge of joy that filled my whole being and brought tears to Jeanne's eyes. If today I try to analyze this feeling, I can find many different things in it. Certainly this joy came first and foremost from Jeanne, from her scent, and the way she used to hold tightly onto my wrist or pout her lips. But there was also the sudden brightness of the shops in a neighborhood that was normally so dark, the hurried air of the passers-by, laden with parcels, the delight of the children in the streets, which all helped to tear us from our world of loneliness. The silver paper round the chocolates was the sign that a confused but noisy and golden period was beginning for the simple-hearted, and Jeanne and I snuggled closer together. Perhaps we were vaguely aware of the particular happiness that a man feels when his life falls into harmony with what he is himself. Normally, we carried the magic desert of our love through a world from which love had disappeared. And on days like this, it seemed that the flame which rose in us when we held hands was the same one which we saw dancing in the shop windows, in the hearts of the workmen who had turned round to look at their children, and in the depths of the pure and icy December sky. A love which cannot bear to face reality is not a real love. But then it's the privilege of noble hearts not to be able to love. His wife. The problem was to discover whether a man such as he could live among this woman's lies without forfeiting his own integrity. A time comes when one can no longer feel the emotion of love. The only thing left is tragedy. Living for someone or for something no longer has any meaning. Nothing seems to keep its meaning except the idea of dying for something. Sexual life was perhaps given to man to divert him from his true path. It is his opium. Within, all is sleep. Outside, things come to life again. At the same time, chastity puts an end to our species, which is perhaps the truth. Everything that she can define seems despicable to her. She says, it's disgusting, it's the sex war. But the sex war exists, and we cannot do anything about it. Men who love all women are on the way to abstraction. They go beyond this world, however things may look from the outside, for they turn away from particular individual cases. The man who would run away from every idea and every abstraction, who really despairs, is the man who loves only one woman, through perseverance with this particular face that cannot satisfy everything. The inevitable end of the movement of absurdity, of rebellion, etc., and consequently the inevitable end of the contemporary world, is compassion, in the original meaning of the word. That is to say, in the last analysis, love and poetry. But this demands an innocence that I have lost. All that I can do is correctly recognize the path leading to it, and allow the time of the innocent to come. At least see this before I die. When we have once seen the glow of happiness on the face of someone we love, we know that there can be no other vocation for a man than to bring forth this light on the faces around him. And we are plunged into anguish at the thought of the sorrow and night, which, by the simple fact of being alive, we cast into the hearts we meet. People insist on confusing marriage and love on the one hand, and love and happiness on the other, but they have nothing in common. And this is why, the absence of love being more frequent than love, there are happy marriages. He longed for two things, of which the first was absolute possession. The second was the absolute memory that he wished to leave her. Men are so well aware that love is condemned to death that they work at the memory of that love all the time they live in it. He wanted to leave her with a great idea of himself, so that their love would be permanently great. But he now knew that he was not great himself, and that one day, sooner or later, she would discover this, and that instead of an absolute memory, it would be for him, at least, absolute death. Victory, the only victory, would be to recognize that love can be great, even when the lover is not. But he was not yet ready for this terrible modesty. He carried with him, branded with a hot iron, the memory of her face distorted by pain. It was about then that he lost the self-esteem, which had up to that moment always borne him up. Not up to the level of love. She was right. One can love in chains, across stone walls, several yards thick, etc. But once the slightest portion of the heart is subjected to duty, true love is impossible. He would imagine a future of loneliness and suffering, and his imaginings gave him a difficult kind of pleasure. But this was because he thought of suffering as noble and harmonious. But in fact, what he was then imagining was a future free of suffering. From the moment that pain was there, on the contrary, life departed. Not ethics, but achievement. And there is no achievement other than that of love. That is to say, denying oneself and dying to the world. Go through to the very end. Disappear. Dissolve oneself in love. A moment always comes when people stop fighting and tearing each other to pieces, and finally agree to love each other for what they are. It's the kingdom of heaven. Novel. He remembered that one day, in the course of one of those atrocious scenes in which he grew more aware of the horrors the future held in store, she told him that she had sworn to herself that she would belong only to him, and that never again, once he'd gone, would anyone matter for her. And at that moment, when she thought she was telling him what was highest and most irreplaceable in their love, when she was in fact telling him of this, at that moment, when she thought she was tying him, absorbing him into her, the thought came to him, on the contrary, that he was free, and that the moment had come for him to flee and leave her there, certain of her absolute fidelity and sterility. But that day, he stayed, as on the others. Novel. Love fulfills itself or degrades. The mutilation which it finally leaves behind is all the greater the more love itself miscarries. If love is not creative, it forever prevents any true creation. It is a tyrant and a mediocre one. Thus, P felt troubled at having put himself in the position of loving without being able to give everything to that love. In this absurd waste of time and soul, he did recognize a kind of justice, which, in the final analysis, was the only one he'd ever found on this earth. But the recognition of this justice meant at the same time the recognition of a duty, that of hoisting this love and themselves above mediocrity, and of accepting the most terrible but the frankest suffering. The one before which, with pounding heart, mad with cowardice, he had forever been retreating. He could neither do more than he did, nor be other than he was, and the only love which would have saved everything was one where he was accepted as he was. But love cannot accept what is. It is not for this that it makes its voice heard over the whole earth. It shouts to refuse goodness, compassion, intelligence, everything which leads to compromise. It shouts out for the impossible, the heavens in flame, inexhaustible springtime, love stronger than death, and death itself transfigured into eternal life. How then could he have been accepted in love? He who, in a certain way, was only wretchedness and awareness of this wretchedness. He alone could accept himself. By accepting the long, unending, and atrocious pain of losing love and of knowing that he'd lost it through his own fault, there lay his liberty, flowing with a terrible blood, it's true. But that was also the condition on which something at least could be created within the limits that were his, in the consecration of his own wretchedness and in the wretchedness of every life, but also in the effort to achieve greatness, which was his only justification. Within this torture, any weakness gives back to love its puerile and stupid face, turns it into that vain and haggard constriction against which the least demanding heart finally rebels. Yes, that was what he had to say. I love you, but I am nothing, or very little. And you cannot really accept me in spite of all your love. In the depths of your soul, at the very roots of your being, you demand everything, and I neither am nor have everything. Forgive me for having less soul than love, less luck than desire, and for loving above my reach. Forgive me and cease humiliating me. When you cease to be able to love me, you'll be able to be just towards me. On that day, you will measure my hell, and you will then love me above ourselves, with a love which will never be enough for me either, but which I shall nevertheless put on the balance sheet of life in order to accept it once again in suffering. Yes, that was true. But then the most difficult part began. When she was away, the days cried out, and each night was a wound.
That was John Shrapnel reading extracts from Carnet, The Notebooks of Albert Camus, translated by Philip Thody and selected by Anthony Asprey. The program was directed by John Theocharis.